Hello, welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN. Good to have you with us. What a weekend we're going to get into. Ravens Steelers lived up to the hype, no doubt about that. The Saints get it done the hard way. The Seahawks, much more straightforward for them. We're going to get into all of the big stories from Week 8 Sunday in the NFL. Ben Isaac's back in the house. Let's get straight to it. Ben, welcome back to the show, man. We love having you on so much that we thought back-to-back appearances were in order.
Yeah, you've got to give the public what they want, or contrary to public demand. I don't know, one of the two.
One of the two will work. Speaking of public demand, we're all pretty hyped up about Ravens Steelers, and it lived up to that bidding. What a game.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. I mean, we know it's one of the best rivalries in the NFL, and that's partly because it's two teams that have played a similar style through the years of tough, brutal defense, absolute kind of like black and blue football, which you love to see. And this one was a wild one. And so often, especially it feels like the 6 p.m. early slot, there'll be a game in there that I'll get absolutely really hyped about, and then it'll be a damp squib. And this one wasn't. But halfway through, I thought, okay, it's another letdown.
It's interesting that it was in this slot. We were getting into this on our radio show last night. It was surprising when you looked at what was in the later slot and Sunday Night Football, which considering there's always this talk of the top-heavy windows, the early window being too top-heavy, and the NFL should balance it out a little bit more. But that's usually okay when there is a storming game in the second window. And I guess they figured at the time that the Hawks 49ers would be that game, you know, not the injuries notwithstanding, obviously, for San Francisco making that not a particularly fair fight. And, you know, Saints had something about it, but this was clearly the headline act of the weekend. So surprising it was in the 6 o'clock slot. Do you like the fact it's in an early slot?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. There was my favorite time to watch a game is that 6 p.m. slot, especially if you've had the build up, and then that sort of sets it up. I'm always much more alert for that 6 p.m. game rather than Sunday Night Football, where I am always in a daze. Thankfully, obviously, I don't need to talk about this one because you need to be in a daze to actually get through it. But with this one, if you've got that treat early, though, it's a very difficult act to follow. No other game managed to live up to this one. I mean, it was obviously it had a great finish, but it was the classic tale of two halves and a tale of two quarterbacks. And Lamar Jackson, the reigning NFL MVP, he lost the game for the Baltimore Ravens. Now, don't get me wrong. That's not to say there's any sort of quarterback controversy, or is Lamar Jackson elite?
That's what I want to hear out of your mouth.
Oh, he is eliter than Joe Flacco.
Joe Flacco, for all you Americanist listeners out there. All right, let's talk about this, though, because the second time the Steelers have done this to Lamar, we talked about this on the preview show, of course, that last season in his MVP season, Lamar was rattled by the Steelers in a way that no other team managed to do that. Same again, right? He was sacked four times. That is tied second in terms of his entire career for the most number of sacks he's taken. Turnovers were obviously an issue as well. With one or two exceptions, he couldn't really get into any kind of rhythm with the passing game. His usually explosive running game was very much apparent, but as you say, he had the turnover issue there, the fumble issue there. So it was, by all accounts, an under par performance from him. 13-28, 208 yards, two touchdowns, two picks was the final line. Three times he fumbled, and of course, two of them ended up in turnovers.
Yeah, those turnovers, if you give four of them away, obviously it's difficult to win a game. He could have probably got away with just two, maybe three turnovers, and they still would have won because of how the lead that they had built up in that first half. Some of them were mental errors. Some of it was him forcing it. Some of it was him trying to do too much. And you do get that with a player like that. He is a special player. He's a leader. He puts the team on his back, and he is incredibly talented, and he can do it all. We've seen him do it all. But Pittsburgh know how to defend him more than any other team. Obviously, they see him twice a season, but that's not helped the Browns and the Bengals up against Lamar Jackson. The Steelers frequently were putting a fifth linebacker there to basically keep Lamar Jackson honest. It made it more difficult for him to do things just short over the middle, or to make those designed runs through the gaps. And it was an absolute masterstroke. The way the Steelers were coached in the second half is is just as important as the mistakes Lamar Jackson made, because he was forced into those mistakes by good defense. It wasn't just Lamar Jackson having a terrible day, because he did some fantastic things as well. It was just the Steelers' defense was absolutely superb.
Well, it was very much a tale of two halves, particularly for the Steelers. Again, of course, it was the inverse last time out against the Titans, when they were looked in complete control and then were very different both sides of the board in the second half there. Same thing here, in particular the offense, which was terrible in the first half, but in the second half. And of course, we understand these two things are connected, of course, that the more effective your defense is playing, then it does have an obvious impact, and vice versa, and particularly the latter. If the offense, if you're controlling the clock, controlling the ball, giving a defense a breather, then of course that is going to have a significant impact. And the fact that the offense just wasn't there at all in the first half, but was much more competent in the second half, I think had a clear bearing on how the Steelers' D was playing in the second half as well. But what changed? Because Roethlisberger in particular, Ben, we've talked about the evolution of this Steelers offense this season, how he's got this collection of brilliant receivers around, and that he likes the short game to them, right? He likes to dink and dunk it around. That just couldn't get in any kind of rhythm in the first half. But the second half, much better. A 7.5 yard average depth of target, Roethlisberger. 23 of his 32 attempts were on passes less than 10 yards. So they got into that rhythm and type, what has been effective against most teams this season. And did it again against the Ravens. What changed? How were they able to get that going in the second half, do you think?
For me, the big thing was in the second half, they were able to really spread out the Ravens' defense. Frequently, they would have these packages with four wide receivers and a tight end going across the middle. So it was an empty backfield. He would have five targets. Five people to target, which he was not doing in the first half. That was something that was only put on in the third quarter. It created a lot of mismatches, and it lessened the effect that Humphreys and Peters, the very physical Baltimore cornerbacks, had, because there were then other options for him in the sort of short to intermediate range. And it really seemed to baffle the Ravens defense. They just could not handle doing that. They were so spread out, they were unable to do the man coverage that they wanted to do, and it completely flipped the game.
J.K. Dobbins, of course, rookie coming in to the league, played very well, looking promising really in terms of that tag team with Gus Edwards. Tell us a bit more about Dobbins as a college expert. What was he like in college, and are you surprised about how capable he looked last night?
No, not surprised at all. He's someone he's very efficient and also knack for big plays, could grind out hard yards, a good all-rounder. I felt the Ravens was a great landing spot for him, because the way they love to run the ball, and they will commit to the run, and they will create these lanes for the running backs. I wasn't at all surprised. I think he's going to have an excellent season. 113 yards was well deserved. There were some great runs as well that were called back for holding as well. It was
it's a nice tag team as well with Edwards, right? Because Dobbins just seems to be kind of hitting the edges more, and Gus Edwards old school in terms of up the gut. So that just seems to be a nice tandem. When you throw Lamar in the mix as well, that's something that the Ravens faithful can look at as a very promising outcome from this game. Ronnie Stanley going down, not so much, right?
I mean, brutal.
Brutal for him, brutal for the team, and of course, it just on a massive contract as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're in his shoes, then obviously you're very, very pleased that you got that contract done when you did. That's financially a huge boost for him, but such a loss when they are so reliant on the way that offensive line protects Jackson and opens up those lanes. Now, someone listening might be thinking, well, of course, it's obvious you need a good offensive line, but the way that the Ravens play and run the ball, that offensive line has to be almost perfect at times. And they were frequently almost perfect last season, which allowed Lamar Jackson to have that MVP year. The Ravens will still go to the playoffs, but it's now a much harder route to actually winning that division. You know, not only are they a couple of games behind the unbeaten Steelers, but the Steelers have obviously already now got a tiebreaker over the Ravens. It's going to be tough. The Ravens are unlikely to get a home playoff game, whatever that's going to feel like, you know, with pretty much empty stadiums. So the sky isn't falling in, but it's unlikely, I would say, at this stage they're going to win that division. And because they've lost to such bitter rivals, I'm sure a lot of Ravens fans are feeling really down this morning, but they'll get over it. This is the team will bounce back. They have not become a bad team. They were outcoached, they were outplayed, and still almost won.
Yeah, and it's interesting. That's definitely the positive. The flip side, I guess, of that is certainly accentuating the positives for the Steelers. Jim Trotter on NFL.com, the headline of his game review, the Steelers beating the Ravens without their A game is a scary proposition for the rest of the NFL. It's a great point, really, that when you see a team like this play abjectly in the first half and turn it around, and even the second half, clearly significantly better, but as Trotter says, not bringing their elite stuff and getting a win against one of the strongest teams in the AFC, one of the strongest teams in the NFL, they're absolutely legit. And in a season, Ben, when records can be deceptive, are absolutely deceptive in the case of the Bears, you look at their early season record to what we're how we're evaluating them now, the Packers, there's question marks about them as well. Seattle shut up a few of the haters. We'll get into that game in a bit. But going into the 49ers game, there's a lot of talk of, I'm not sure Seattle are legit with this record. Their defense is terrible, yada, yada, yada. The Steelers seem to be the most authentic team in terms of their record, their position, and the level that they're actually at.
Yeah, I would say the two most complete teams, it feels like to me, if you were gonna pick a Super Bowl right now,
Steelers Bucks.
Exactly. Those are the two teams that are such all round rosters. The way they're putting games together, the Bucks are perhaps better than their record suggests. I think the Steelers deserve to be undefeated. Those two teams, you know, it's not like a collision course is already set, it's only the first week of November. But if any team, I would say, deserves to be 6-0 and, you know, just 7-0, 8-0, I don't know how far the Steelers are going to go in terms of kind of avoiding defeat. You know, they're not going to go unbeaten. But right now, this is the best team in the NFL. I would be frightened to face them. They were only okay yesterday and they beat an elite team. In fact, the Ravens, I saw the first team since 1950 to outrush their opponents by more than 200 yards and outpass them by any amount and still lose. So what happened last night is simply unheard of. And that's the greatness of this Steelers team. And Ben Roethlisberger, he's not physically the player that he was, but mentally he's even better than he was. His brain is quicker than it was. He's got a few more seasons left in him, isn't it? And I wasn't sure I was going to be saying that at this point of the year. He has been unreal with the way that he puts that game plan together and grinds out these wins is absolutely stunning.
I love watching his evolution, the different type of player that he has become. One more on this one and we'll get on to your Bears, because you talked about this great rivalry, the Saints with the Ravens and the Steelers, and that was absolutely living up to the billing in terms of the game as it played out. But of course, also the needle. And we would never advocate fisticuffs on this show, Ben, as you know. That's absolutely not the position we would adopt. Nevertheless, if there was a game where you want to see that level of passion and that level of altercation, I think it's Ravens-Steelers. It always wouldn't be a Ravens-Steelers game without it.
Oh, no. I mean, if they could get at each other the way that they would like to, the games would have to be on after the watershed. We would never see them at 6 p.m. because they would not be safe for children to watch. The hatred between these two teams and the aggression that they have towards each other is an absolute thing of beauty. It makes me kind of want to do a chef kiss every time I see it, when they're kind of jawing at each other. And let's not forget, you know, when you and I were growing up watching the NFL in the 1980s, there were no Baltimore Ravens. This isn't a rivalry like the Bears-Packers that goes back to 1921. You know, this is just since the 90s, but they've just hated each other since then, and it's great to see. I mean, the Browns hate the Ravens because the Ravens stole the Browns franchise in the 90s, but the Ravens fans just kind of pity the Browns. It's all about the Steelers for them. Their hatred is wonderful.
Got to feel sorry for Matt Judon. that ejection, I think that was pretty hard. Just another complete, as soon as he's touched an official, he's gone. They wish they would apply a little bit of common sense and nuance to these situations, as opposed to having this absolute rule, which is balmy.
Yeah, there was at least one more justified ejection last night, certainly.
We'll get to that. All right. Let's talk Saints-Bears. because the Saints made it harder, really, than it should have been, given how woeful this Bears offense was. I think that's fair to say. I mean, Montgomery picked up something on the ground, receivers dropping balls left, right, and center, Foles not at the races at all. But we know this about the Bears. We know that the offense is poor. We know the defense is strong. And very much it was Akeem Hicks and co. that kept Chicago very much in this game. But despite the injuries, Ben, that the Saints had, or the absences, I should say, with Thomas and Sanders most notably, they seem to be in control of this game for a lot of it and let the Bears back in. And how worried should the Saints fans be about that?
I think this was an off game for the Saints. I think they should just feel like they're relieved that they got out of there with a win. I saw one Bears beat writer say last night that both teams tried to lose and the Bears just tried harder. And that to me summed it up. It was a pretty poor performance from both teams. The Saints were able to kind of grind it out against a very tough Bears defense, who kept putting the offense in positions to make plays, and the offense is exactly as we've seen it since Foles came in. If anything, Montgomery made some runs that everyone was surprised by, because the Saints defense is tough to run against.
Yeah.
And the Bears rushing offense is, since Foles took over, has got substantially worse, because Foles can't run the ball and Mitch Trubisky could, so he was another weapon there. So when the Bears at the end of the second half were very close to getting like a 2-score lead, which then instead of getting a touchdown, they got a field goal, and then they let the Saints have enough time to score a touchdown, partly because Matt Nagy took a timeout, which gave the Saints time, because he was thinking the defense was going to make a stop on like third and 13, whatever it was, and I'm not blaming Matt Nagy for that. But the Saints just kept grinding the whole time. They were a very, very tough team. They were just, like you say, they've got those absences, but they just seem to kind of rise to the occasion when they needed to and kind of tough it out, which is perhaps not the Saints of old. There was not a whole lot of finesse going on. This was a far more brutal victory. If the Saints win the Super Bowl, then I don't think anybody in the kind of elites is going to be pointing to that game as a spectacular one. But it could be a very, very crucial one in terms of the way that the team mentally develops, because they were put in a tough situation. It was a windy day. They missed the kick in part because of that wind, and they were still able to make it count and take advantage of a bad offense and find a way past a very good defense.
Yeah, and as we expected, this would be the case. Alvin Kamara, a significant part of this, key protagonist, both on the ground and out of the backfield as well, right? So we knew that Peyton would go to him early on, establish that his role in the game. We talked about it on the show last week, didn't we? And that's absolutely what they did. More of the same from Breeze. If you're looking at the data on how he performed, great completion rate was up to around 75% there, but average depth 5.4 yards, 75% of his throws were caught short of the sticks, PFF outline. So we know, we're certain what we've got now, right? There are, you know, times when Brady's deep ball has been criticized. Roethlisberger's actually, and he demonstrated he could still air it out on a few occasions yesterday. Even Rivers, and we'll talk more about another good performance from him. Out of this aging veteran crew, there are clearly the elements have declined from where they were 6, 7, 10 years ago. Breeze seems to be the most acute, right? But we knew this, and I guess this was a blueprint, a prototype, as you rightly say, up against one of the better defenses in the NFL, minus a couple of their key pieces, for this offense still to get the job done. There's still enough about it with the game planning of Peyton, the smarts of Breeze, and still a lot of technical ability there, even if he doesn't have the deep ball. And a player like Kamara in the mix, that they can get it done.
Yeah, I mean, Kamara's a playmaker, and Breeze was just making intelligent decisions almost the whole game. When he wasn't going deep, it's because that wasn't there and the underneath was, and had faith in the players to get yards after the catch, even if he was throwing short of the sticks. He played really well. Got to give a lot of credit to the Saints offensive line, who were able to, you know, keep Breeze clean, because the Bears defense obviously was good and the D-line was pretty good, but he's so savvy, and his everyone is on the same page with that Saints offense. You know, it was as a Bears fan, it wasn't fun to watch that. But I love Drew Brees and I love the way he operates. And it was a very intelligent, assured performance from him. It hasn't got to be the showy stuff. He's got to win games. I don't think he's worried about kind of what people are saying about his deep ball. Mm. He's worried about the Saints record, and the Saints record is good.
Very well said. Let's get on to the elephant in the room. Mm. So Javon Wims, ejected from the game for just throwing a roundhouse right out of nowhere, sucker punch, really, on Chauncey Gardner-Johnson, who was the player, of course, that was involved in the altercation with Michael Thomas in training, right? So what, any backstory on this, man? What the hell was going on there?
Yeah, basically there is backstory. Johnson has history with the Bears. When they played last season, he annoyed quite a lot of the Bears players non-stop talking. I mean, he's known as a trash talker. Now, in college, when he was at Florida, this was his reputation, a trash talker who would get players ejected. Mm. He would provoke them, and he would get them to cross a line. There was a big game against Florida State, and he said that the strategy against Florida State was to just provoke them because he said they were the most undisciplined team in America, and we're going to take advantage of every little opportunity.
Now, where do you stand on that? Do you think that's fair game? I mean, if you know, trash talking has always been a part of football, or certainly for an incredibly long time. It's no surprise that corners and receivers are going at it. They do throughout most of the game a lot of the time. We see it all the time. Is it where are you on that strategy of deliberately antagonizing an opponent to get
Well, let me put it this way, right? I'm a Chicago Bears fan. Mm. My favorite college team is Florida State. I have no time for CJ Johnson. However, what he's doing is smart football. If you can get under your opponent's skin, force them into mental errors, then do it. Mm. Absolutely do it. Now, not only had he annoyed a lot of Bears players last season, he also pushed his fingers through Anthony Miller's face mask to get to his face earlier in the game. Mm. And Wims hasn't confirmed that's what did it, but this was clearly premeditated.
It was definitely on the play itself. Nothing happened, right?
He walked up behind him to approach him, snatched a chain or something, hit him in the face, which is pointless. Well, hit him in the side of the helmet, pointless. Did it again, still pointless. Now, obviously, Johnson's got form for this. Mm. This is his MO. He will wind players up. Even his own teammates try to punch him. You know, Michael Thomas is suspended because he doesn't like Johnson and punched him in practice. So the idea that Wims, who funnily enough, has also got a reputation, because in training camp season before last, he started punching Prince Namukamara, who had a helmet on. So you've got...
He hasn't even learned.
No, you've got the league's top helmet puncher and the league's top provoker. You put them together, the provoker is going to get punched in the helmet by Wims. In hindsight, it's the most obvious thing in the world. Now,
it happened, of course. I wonder if there was some Vegas book that was offering money on that. It's interesting that this side, because it was a sucker punch, right? So why... Absolutely. You're not going to wait for a player to take the helmet off. You're obviously not going to ask him to take the helmet off because that would kind of give up the game. So you kind of figure that's probably why Wims is going for the helmet punch. My favorite point of all of it, was Troy Aikman's line. And fair play, in Troy Aikman's defense, we were all watching it. What the hell just happened? Did that just happen? And I'm watching it again and again. So watching the Fox crew, watching the replays, Buck and Aikman. And then Aikman comes out with the immortal line as they were watching another, like the 15th replay of it. That's just not smart football.
I mean, that's amazing line. That's the insight that you can only get from a three-time Super Bowl champion on Fox for quote-unquote America's Game of the Week. Now,
not smart football.
I mean,
I love Aikman.
Like, the thing is that obviously I'm not going to defend. I'm not going to defend Wims over this. Obviously, it was actually not perhaps a turning point in the game, but it obviously was a big penalty on the Bears, who then had to go deep on third down through an interception, and the Saints ended up scoring on the next possession.
Right.
But he is someone who clearly, if his manhood is challenged, if he feels that one of his teammates is being punked by someone he does not respect, he is going to go after him. Now, I went to the sort of school where this is exactly what people would do. You know, I would say half my friends will have sucker punched someone because of the fact they tried to jump some friends of mine from school. And these things happen. When you've got people who are full of testosterone, they will start making bad decisions. So I get it. But like the fact that Wims, after he'd done it, he went off celebrating. He was thrilled with what he'd done. That is what blew my mind more than anything. Somebody being really angry about something and deciding, I'm going to get my revenge, getting the revenge, but then being like, ha, I showed them. What?
Odds what? Of Wims being in the WWE within 12 months.
Well, he's got a better chance of that than being on the Bears by the end of the season, I would say. And that's a shame because I do like the guy. But he's, do you know what? I would say it's just not smart football, Matt. That's the only way I can sum it up.
A great hot take. Let's talk Seahawks, who blew the 49ers away. And as we're talking about the top of the show, wasn't a given, right? The line was 3. A lot of people were saying, oh, this could be a 49ers win. I was hearing arguments being put very much for that. It wasn't even close. So, of course, Jimmy G, going out of the game injured, some might say that maybe improved the 49ers' chances. But look, you lose your starting quarterback, it inevitably is going to have some bearing, or we've got to add some inflection to our assessment of the result. But it was a comprehensive performance once again from the Seahawks offense. And if it isn't Tyler Lockett, then it's DK Metcalf, right? And Metcalf, because visually he looks just significantly more powerful than anyone else around him, seemingly. So that really, really highlights and underpins his explosive nature. But he was brilliant once again, Metcalf, and he's fast becoming, I think, the most dangerous, terrifying, depending on which side of the line you're on, receiver in the NFL right now.
Yeah, I love watching him. He's got this fantastic catch radius where it just seems that even though it's far away from him, he can pull them in. And we talk a lot about contested catches. You do not want to contest the catch with this guy because he will be able to kind of like bully the secondary and get the ball.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the kind of, it's a great point, the kind of player, historically, he reminds me of him. There's elements of Megatron around him in the sense that they can throw it up in here. But it's more than that. I mean, he's physically, Megatron was obviously a powerful figure, but he's just more rounded and built, isn't he? It's almost like a fast defensive end playing receiver. It's just
I thought you were going to go with kind of like a super speedy tight end who as just kind of, he's one of those sort of tweeners, but no, he is a bit like a defensive end, and you don't want a defensive end who can catch the ball. That is nightmare fuel.
He's and the Hawks are looking so dangerous with the aerial attack that, as Ollie, our producer, was talking about in... I've got to mention the running order, right? Because Ollie gets very cross when we deviate from the running order, which I think I have quite a few times already.
The running order is a suggestion.
It is. But he made a great point there that, you know, pick your poison, right? If you take out one of them, the other one is let's celebrate Javon Wims. The other one's going to sucker punch you. But I mean, that's what happened here. They kept Lockett, who went off last week, of course, in 200 plus yards. They kept him relatively quiet, and Metcalf was the one that did the damage. And this is, if I bring this around to the Browns a little bit, just that whole Odell Beckham situation, because this is something that came up in conversation on a radio show last night, and of course in my Times article last week, Ben, that you'd have read, right? You read that?
Yeah. Of course.
Of course you did. And people saying, well, are the Browns better without Odell Beckham on the field? And all these stats get wheeled out. And yeah, you can't deny the validity of the stats to some degree. But what they don't apply is individuality of situations. So that if Beckham is connecting 14% less with Mayfield than the rest of his receivers, but what are those catches? How explosive are they? How game-changing are they? And most importantly, or as importantly, what does that defense have to think about when he's on the field, right? And this is what the Seahawks have when they have, and any team with a really powerful receiving talent, the Steelers going back to them in a different way and different styles of receiver. But you've got to be looking at so carefully at both of them. They are both essentially number one receivers.
Yeah, and the thing is that if you're coming up against the Seahawks, you know how to beat them. You've just got to shut those two down. Easy, right? That's all you got to do. That's all you got to do. But the thing is, it's like trying to bring a knife to a gunfight when you face Seattle, because how on earth are you going to do that? There will be times where things just don't click, or that the defense is just too leaky. But a lot of the times they are going to be like they were last night. Now, they kept letting the 49ers back in the game, and the 49ers are not a particularly good team. And I'm not the biggest fan of Jimmy Garoppolo, but like you say, when you lose your starter, even if your starter may not be your starter next season, the fact is the guy who's coming in has not been having first team reps. He is not as schooled on what should be done as the starter. And even with a second stringer in, the 49ers were able to make gains against the Seahawks defense. So you do have to really put up points against the Seahawks, because you know they're going to do the same to you. This 49ers team, I don't know what to make of them. I said last week they may be the best coach team in the NFL because they've got so many players out, and yet they still are competitive. But if the Seahawks play like that, there's not many teams that can hang with them, right?
I don't think there are. And we've got to, when we're talking about this performance, because you can only beat who's in front of you, right? That's my Aikman hot take of the day. But the 49ers clearly have been banged up all season long, and you look at the ground game and people say, well, they only averaged 2.4 yards a carry against this Steelers D, and which incidentally is obviously better against the run than it is against the pass, right? But nevertheless, they were without Mostert, they were without Coleman. What are you expecting? Garoppolo might be indifferent, but he went out. You got Nick Mullins coming in. I'm not buying that's any kind of remote upgrade, irrespective of anything else. I tell you what I really, really rate is Brandon Ayuk. I really, really like another big game again, but just have a feeling that out of that brilliant receiving core that came into the draft this year, he is going to be one of the ones that goes the furthest. On that, on drafts and receivers, why was DK Metcalf, why did he fall so much? Was it just, did people whiff on him, or was there off the field issues, or what was the book on Metcalf?
Well, no, I mean, you know, he fell to the second round. A lot of great receivers end up being drafted in the second round, because there are, in recent seasons, there have been a lot of good wide receivers. So they are not so much at a premium that you'd have to take them in the first round. It's worth bearing in mind that in college, I think he made less than 70 catches in his entire college career and had about 1,200 yards. So he certainly had the highlights, but it's not like this is someone who'd been putting up absolutely amazing numbers. You could see the tape of him at Ole Miss, and you can see the talent there. Mm. But he wasn't like a Jerry Jeudy, where it was like video game numbers for multiple years, where you feel like, we've seen so much of this guy, we've seen so many catches. Mm. He seems unreal. Metcalf was someone who looked like a very, very promising wide receiver who could be a very good starter in the NFL. He's already better than a very good starter in the NFL. But I wouldn't say teams whiffed on him. I think based on what he'd done in college, I think a second round pick was fair. And the Seahawks got a bargain because he's even better than that.
Okay. Just one other point on this. I'm just kind of reflecting on the Mullins-Garoppolo thing for a minute. Maybe I've done Mullins a bit of a disservice, because they were demonstrably better when he was playing, but it just doesn't seem to be, to me, an automatic upgrade. But maybe I'm missing the point here. I mean, do you think there is a quarterback controversy going on here? I mean, Garoppolo is injured, so that is affecting his output and a big investment in him. But I wonder, you know, I wonder how many more times they can, this season in particular, if they want to contend for a wild card, how many more times they suffer a performance like that?
Yeah, I think the only way that Mullins is an upgrade over Garoppolo is when you consider the fact that Garoppolo isn't healthy. And although I'm repeating myself, I'm not his biggest fan, when he's healthy, he can be very effective. When he's not healthy, he can't do those things that have made him effective, making those good decisions, making those quick passes. And he's just an unreliable guy at the moment. But I don't see there being a controversy this season. I don't know which way they're going to go towards the end of the season, because they are still in playoff contention because of the way that things will go. And there is an extra playoff place in the NFC and the AFC both. They can still make the playoffs. But they can get rid of Jimmy G at the end of this season without it costing them a fortune. They'll have a decision to make at the end of the year. And if you were the 49ers right now, putting you on the spot, would you keep him? Because I wouldn't. I would be looking for another option.
I 100% would, you know, but I'm not going to bore our listeners with another Jimmy G apologist rant. Suffice to say, I think he is an underrated quarterback. He's clearly injured. The team is banged up. Look at the ground game he had. It's not, getting a realistic reflection of him. And I think it's the same mistake that so many GMs make, which is careful what you wish for. Careful what you wish for. And that brings us nicely to the Dolphins and their win against the Rams, one of the big upsets of the weekend. And of course, the big story going into it was Tua's first start, but it wasn't the most auspicious of performances from Tua, but he didn't need it to be because his defense and special teams swung the game pretty comprehensively in the end, Ben, for the Dolphins, given its a first start in the NFL against Aaron Donald and Cohen. And we suspected that would be very much welcome to the NFL. And Donald strip sacked him, which of course led to the Rams' first score. And that was a pretty brutal introduction to the big leagues. We knew it was going to be tough against this front seven. Jalen Ramsey in the back, in the secondary going out injured or ill early on made his life a little bit easy. But nevertheless, it wasn't the explosive, exciting performance that I think some people were hoping for. What do you make of Tua's debut?
Yeah, I thought, because I'm like most people and like you, I'm big on Tua. I think he's going to have a good NFL career, and I think the Dolphins did a great thing picking him. But I expected there to be a bit more boom and bust in the first game. I thought you would either go off and just be torching the Rams in some plays, even if the Dolphins lost. I thought he would make some amazing highlight plays, or it would just be too much for him at that point. Because don't forget, he's not played a lot of football because of the injury last season. And it was more of the bust, but the team seemed to really rally around him. The team clearly supports him. They know he's the future. He knows he's the future, which gives you a lot of confidence. You know that if they'd lost that game, nobody's like, oh, maybe they did the wrong thing with that pick. He's going to be the future. He looked very, very average yesterday. They didn't really open up the playbook for him. It was all a little bit kind of vanilla, I think. The Rams were very disappointing. Tua did not win this game for them. You know, they won despite Tua. There'll be plenty of games in the future where he's going to win games for them. But he wasn't great yesterday, and I'm not going to get down on him about that. I tell you who was great, though. His brother, on Friday night, he made his first college start and was absolutely sensational. So that's another tongue of I love.
Where's he playing?
But he's playing at Maryland, so not as big a program, but he had a fantastic comeback.
Was it a shootout?
Comeback win. Oh, yeah, it really was. I was staying up with the puppy, and I put the game on at halftime. Minnesota were well ahead, and I thought, well, I've got nothing else to do. I'm going to watch this, and he engineered a comeback that was fantastic. He's not as good as Tua, although he is certainly an NFL prospect who we'll see in a few seasons. It was great to see Tua start a game, though. It's been so long, but the fact that Jalen Ramsey wasn't around was a real blessing for him.
Made life easier. And conversely, Brian Flores really got in Jared Goff's head. Of course, much as he was able to the Super Bowl a few years back, right? It was taking a leaf out of that playbook, confusing him, mixing up coverages. This is clearly one of the ways you can get to Goff. And I don't want to go down that old line of, oh, McVay's in his head all the time, because I think Goff's a better player than that. And it's a little bit patronizing to Goff to say that he is an Autobot that is being... Autobot? Is he an Autobot or is he Decepticon? I don't know. There's a whole other show. But, you know, this kind of automatron, can't think for himself type player, which I think is unreasonable. Nevertheless, he does seem to be one of those players. We talk about Breeze's smarts, right? And again, maybe not a fair comparison, Ben, when you look at a future Hall of Famer who's been playing for 15 years longer than Goff. But that's what we mean when we talk about that, right? He can see things, read things, that the ability that you have as a thinker, when you're a vet that's achieved as much. Rivers too, you can see what is going on. I know Rivers is prone to erratic mistakes, but generally speaking, that's a huge advantage, which Goff just doesn't have yet because he doesn't have the benefit of experience, but also just doesn't seem to instinctively be very good at that. You can get inside his head and confuse him, and that's very much what the Finns did.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind, because I feel that Goff isn't quite as smart a player as he needs to be to make up for some of his physical shortcomings, but he was a hell of a lot better against the Bears defense last week, and that is a better defense than the one in Miami. The Rams are a bit too inconsistent. Goff's a bit too inconsistent. Maybe it was a trap game. Maybe they kind of just took their eye off the ball because they had a convincing win last week and now this happened. I mean, I saw lots of Rams fans I know on Twitter who were just going after Goff and the coaching staff the entire game. There is plenty of ill feeling towards Goff from Rams fans. And I see why, but I think you've got to ride it out. He's by no means a bad quarterback. He's very, very much above average, but he has got these flaws. And I don't think we've seen any evidence that those flaws are going away. I think that's him. What we're seeing from Goff is what you're going to get forever.
That's a really, really fair point. That's a really fair point. The positives for the Rams, a couple of rookies to talk about. Van Jefferson had a few grabs. Cam Akers as well looked all right, didn't he? So there is, they're certainly not done, the Rams, but they are baffling, aren't they? Just seem to lurch from one week to the next. You think, they're contenders. Maybe they're not. I'm not so sure.
And if there's a division that you can't afford to be inconsistent in, I think this is the one. You can't do it. You've got to be on your game far more than the Rams are, because the Cardinals are going to take wins off teams. The 49ers are going to take wins off teams. Even if the Cardinals and 49ers don't make the playoffs, they could ruin things for a team such as the Rams. Less so the Seahawks, I would say, but it could be that those division games are what stops the Rams from making the playoffs potentially if they can't iron out these inconsistencies.
So that was Tua's debut. Incidentally, the box score for Tua, just to emphasize the point, 12 for 22, 93 yards and a touchdown. Justin Herbert drafted exactly one place after Tua in the 2020 draft, but has seen much more action, of course, with that bizarre chain of events with the Chargers knocking Tyrod Taylor out. And Herbert has grabbed that opportunity and hasn't looked back. But deeply disappointing defeat for him and for the Chargers. They were 24-3 up against the Broncos and absolutely cruising. And the Broncos, I was watching as Wednesday, I was sort of flipping backwards and forwards, and I was, like I'm sure a lot of our listeners, you have one game on and then you have Red Zone on, social media kind of buzzing around. And I was just keying in for a while on that game in particular, right, with Red Zone flying around. And just thinking, my God, how bad Denver offense looked. When going into the season, I'd spoken to a few different Denver beat writers who were really big on Locke, loved the Judy draft, of course, and were very, very positive about what this team would be able to do offensively. And it looked astonishingly bad. And then it completely turned around. It's fourth quarter, Ben, 14 of 18, 155 yards, three touchdowns, no picks. Quarterback rating was 142.1. Outside of the fact he masterminded the win, which the Broncos absolutely needed to have any chance of keeping this season alive. But I always look at a player who is on the ropes and comes back with a performance like that. Even if they'd lost, it's almost immaterial to me. That showed me a lot about Drew Lock. I think he is a credible player. Why aren't we seeing him do this more? Why aren't we seeing the Broncos do this more?
I think there's a lack of talent on that Denver roster, which makes things difficult for Drew Lock. I'm not that high on Drew Lock. My opinion of him certainly went up last night. I think you're absolutely spot on. Let's say they didn't pull out that win. Let's say the touchdown pass as time expired fell incomplete. You'd still have to look back at that final quarter, look at Drew Lock and say, he really showed us something there. In a very difficult situation, he took the team on his shoulders when not a lot of people have got faith in him, and he did it. I think his teammates have got faith in him, and that counts for a hell of a lot in the locker room. I still don't know what we've got with Drew Lock. I really don't. And as far as the Chargers are concerned, again, I was all over social media while keeping track of all these games. And when the Chargers were winning, the two themes I was getting from Chargers fans that I know were, I can't believe we're running the ball, and B, how are we going to lose this? And that was a common theme. Like, well, Denver don't look good. They haven't looked good all season. But in what way will we lose this? And I don't think anyone guessed, it's just going to be Drew Lock just going absolutely ham and just bawling out in the final quarter. You'd have got good odds on that being part of the capitulation.
Would you've got good odds on the Bengals blowing it against the Titans, as they seem to have done the entire time under under Zach Taylor and the new regime, but they held on. Burrow held on. Another big performance from Burrow. And we talk about composure and what we expect from rookie quarterbacks, which is ideally output, but you're ready for mistakes. And if you flip it back to the Chargers game, Herbert had that, right? He was balling and making things happen, but he was also risky with the ball at times, right? Burrow seems to, out of the rookie quarterbacks, certainly looking at those two, just seems to be a two. We haven't really got enough of a sample size, but Burrow seems to be, removing comparisons, on a fast track to be a stable presence, irrespective of his productivity. He just has that assured, to use your borrow your word from earlier, Ben, that assuredness and that calmness, togetherness that you don't always see in a rookie season with quarterbacks.
Yeah, that's spot on. This is what's been the most impressive part of him. The how self-assured he is. He doesn't seem to get kind of mentally knocked back from the things that are happening. He's got the good sense to know that, you know, last season at LSU, he was anointed the starting quarterback of a team that was absolutely loaded in every position. And he knew that he was going to get picked number one overall, and he was going to go to a team that had a lot of holes. And he doesn't seem to be bothered by that. It's not getting him down. He's, you know, we joked about his nickname, Joey Covers.
Joey Covers.
He's keeping these games close. And with this one, I did think he was going to, well, not he was going to throw it away. I thought the Bengals would throw it away, but cover. But he didn't. And the thing that impressed me the most about the Bengals was he only had a makeshift offensive line in front of him. They've really kind of beaten up and things being moved around on that line. And still he was able to find time, make those passes, the high percentage passes, do the intelligent thing, keep the ball moving. And that is not a game I expected to see the Titans lose. Psychologically, a huge win for the Bengals. They'll know that they can't just hang with teams now. They can beat good teams. And they'll continue to be a tough out from here until the end of the season. You know, they're not going to hit 500, but they're going to be a problem for plenty of teams.
The Titans will scratch their heads on this one. Henry had a pretty decent game on the ground. And if you look statistically, take out the kind of rudimentary numbers of overall yardage and look at it in a bit more detail. PFF's always good for that. They rank that as the most successful ground game of the season. But of course, they couldn't get it done in the air. And this is the fundamental problem, that when everything's chiming for them, they look offensively really, really formidable. But when Tannehill is as inconsistent as he was against the Bengals, they can't seem to rely on Henry to get it done each and every time. So interesting, I think we expect him to be able to run on Cincinnati, given their run D is pretty fragile, but we perhaps rather surprised that Tannehill looked so erratic. Speaking of which, what was going on with Aaron Rodgers and the Packers? Because talk about upsets this weekend, Ben. There was another one there. The Packers were heavy favorites, 7-point favorites, I think, for that game, and nobody really figured that the Vikings were going to keep it close, but it wasn't even close. Minnesota ran away with it.
Yeah, the Vikings, we knew they were better and more talented than their record suggested, but this seemed like an awful matchup on paper for them against the Packers. This did not seem like a potential upset because of the way the two teams matched up, not just because the Packers are better, but because it's Aaron Rodgers against one of the weakest secondaries in the NFL.
Right.
You would never have thought that. If you did not know the records of those two teams, there's no way you would think that the Packers were about four games ahead of the Vikings. The Vikings are going to be spoilers for a few teams. They're not going to make the playoffs, not this season. But with someone like Dalvin Cook, when he's given the room and he's on form, he is an absolute delight to watch. They couldn't stop him. Aaron Rodgers was very average. He didn't seem particularly happy. You know, what a surprise. And they've got to fix these things. I mean, I still think they would win the division. You know, it seems to be a straight battle between them and the Bears. And clearly, even if they had the equal level of talent, having Aaron Rodgers is going to give them the advantage. But they just do not. The fact that they have not been giving Aaron Rodgers the weapons that he needs, there will be these games where it will cause a problem for them.
Yeah, it's a great
point. It will cause a problem in the playoffs.
So Devontae Adams had 7 catches for 53, right? And of course, three scores. No other Packers receiver had multiple catches on the day. The rest of the Packers receivers combined for three catches for 61 yards. So, I mean, if Aaron Rodgers wants to justify his frustration, his anger at what went down in the draft, just email that stat to the powers that be. Are they going to make a move, do you think, before the deadline and strengthen his hand?
I mean,
Packers like to do that, right?
Exactly. It'd be very unpackers like. And it would almost be admitting defeat that, yeah, we got it wrong in the draft, which they would be loath to do. Mm. And I think, although there has obviously been plenty of friction between Rodgers and the coaching team, pretty much through his entire time in Green Bay, because of just the Rodgers personality, I think it's going to have to wait until the next draft for them to fix that situation. And they're expecting Rodgers to be able to just pull it out and perform miracles because of how talented he is. And it's only going to work so far, as we've seen in the playoffs. Aaron Rodgers is the most talented quarterback of his generation. I don't care what anybody says. And if he only makes it to one Super Bowl, that something is wrong with the organization when that happens.
Mm. Are the Pats done now for the season? Is Cam done for the season after that defeat?
I really thought they were going to come back and win that. And I thought that the narrative is going to be, you know, are the Patriots going to start sneaking in now? Mm. You know, is Cam Newton going to start firing on all cylinders? I was very high on the Cam Newton pickup. I mean, they got great value. Even if he flops, it's not like they invested a load of money in him. But it has not been working. And that was a bad fumble. But give Cam credit. He came out. He took the defeat on his shoulders. He said it was his fault.
Watch the presser after that he gave.
Yeah.
You're watching a bit, because he got, again, in some quarters, criticized for that because he looked a bit petulant and getting frustrated with the questions. But I'm with Cam on this. I understand and appreciate that you can't be out and out rude and it's part of the gig. And look, we're talking as journalists that it's frustrating when you are faced with an interview subject that is giving you next to nothing and clearly doesn't want to be there. Like, but I sympathize with him. Some of the lines of questioning were frankly ridiculous. Like, what are you expecting him to say? And yet he gets knocked for being throwaway with his answers or clipped with his answers. It does annoy me and frustrate me that certain players just get picked out for behaving badly in that context, but it's kind of justifiable. And when you think about some of the other behavior that is out there,
some people get a pass, some people don't. Cam Newton will never get a pass, and some people will.
Mm.
And it's a bad look. Mm. There are certain things that you can infer from the sort of players who do get judged and those who don't get judged, which I don't like. And on a separate point, I think the level of questions in post-game press conferences has gone downhill since they've all become remote.
Mm.
And I don't know if that's just in my head, but when I'm watching them, it feels like the questions are not as good. There's a lot more questions that I think, what are you expecting here? Yeah. I don't know if there's kind of a level of respect that when you are face to face with that person, you don't necessarily say, but when it's on a video chat, you do. I don't know if that's what plays into it, but
it's an interesting take, Ben. Yeah. I think you're absolutely onto something there, that I'm sure the difference in medium impacts in the same way that plenty of, you know, anonymous keyboard warriors have no issue laying in with all kinds of horrible stuff online. You know, they wouldn't even dream of saying that to somebody's face. I wonder if it's kind of variation of that. Ben, we saved the best till last. We talked about a lot of terrific games in week 8, but quite clearly game of the weekend was Sunday Night Football.
I mean, that's the prime slot, right? You know, that's, if you want smart football, then it's all about the 2020 Eagles and Cowboys, definitely.
What are the Cowboys? I mean, because the Cowboys obviously offset a couple of players as well recently. I mean, they've completely thrown in the towel, right?
It feels that way. I mean, you know, they're not going to win many games with Gucci DiNucci, whereas they could win some with Andy Dalton. The Cowboys are very much a team that is kind of just checked out for the year. They're like, yeah, 2020... it's not been good for anybody. We'll see you next season. But, I mean, to me, the Eagles are the biggest story. the Eagles won this game almost by default. But, you know, at some point, a decision has got to be made about Carson Wentz. Because is he really the future? I this morning, when I was looking back at this Eagles-Cowboys game, knowing that I was going to be talking to you, I thought, I'm sure there was a Monday in November last year where I came on this podcast and it was about Carson Wentz. What is the deal with him? And what can he get any better? And I think the answer right now is no. This is Carson Wentz. For better or worse, they've hitched their wagon to him. Whether that was a bad decision or not, we're going to find out. But this is what we're going to get from Carson Wentz. He is going to be inconsistent. He is going to have bad games. He is going to have to get bailed out. His stat line was terrible. He's throwing interceptions all over the place. The Eagles have got lots of holes. It's not like this is a good team being held back by a lack of quarterback. But he is not a quarterback that can just win games by himself. I'm worried about Carson Wentz's future, personally.
How much do we have to give him a bit of a pass? Because not dissimilar to the 49ers, Philly have been absolutely banged up for quite, and not just this season, right? But last season, of course, in particular, very, very difficult to achieve the levels that we're expecting, which is when he, you know, before his injury, when he was on MVP, in MVP conversations, and it was, oh, okay, here's a top six, top eight quarterback, and he's nowhere near that mark now, but you got to put a lot of that down to both the coaching changes, right? The personnel changes, which I think have been significant and maybe underplayed a little bit, but definitely the injuries and the indifferent performances from his supporting cast.
Absolutely. The season that the Eagles won the Super Bowl, they were such a well-balanced unit. It wasn't necessarily superstars in every position, but they were just so solid from top to bottom. But what happened when Carson Wentz got injured? Nick Foles came in, won every game, won the Super Bowl, won Super Bowl MVP. And Nick Foles is not as good a quarterback as Carson Wentz, that they were able to just put Foles in and everything kept moving. How much credit we can give Wentz for what he did earlier in that season, I don't know. Because even Foles came in and they didn't miss a beat. I don't think he is ever going to be anywhere near that again. I think that purple patch was a bit of a flash in the pan. I felt he was overrated coming out of college, and that's partly because of the fact he played at North Dakota State and he did not face proper college teams on a regular basis, unlike someone like a Tua Tagovailoa. And although he was a real physical specimen, I just felt that he didn't have the smarts to do the things to justify that position in the draft, just like Jared Goff in a way. And I mean, they're kind of stuck with him for the time being, but yeah, it's not going to get any better anytime soon for the Eagles, and they might make the playoffs.
Maybe they can just do a direct swap with Goff. I mean, there's a TV show right there. So two teams that are struggling, just it's some kind of quarterback swap. Or that's the kind of Jeopardy card you can play halfway through the season.
I'd love to see Carson Wentz, who is, and I don't mean this in a negative way, he was like a proper hick. Carson Wentz in LA. I think that would be hilarious. I'd love to see that.
That's a few shows we've developed today. Up with the Puppy, says Borio Lionello. That's a YouTube show I would watch. You watching the Nooch live on YouTube with the Pup. That's an interesting idea, though. It's kind of Jeopardy thing, a bit like the WWE draft where you just start insisting on players moving from one team to another. Just very quickly, we'll wrap, Ben, on the Cowboys, because look, with all due respect to the Nooch, nobody was expecting fireworks from the offense last night. But Amari Cooper, absence again, to all intents and purposes. I mean, he technically suited up and played in the game, not that you would have known it. Zeke Elliott has now gone on a terrible run. So he's gone 8 games without hitting 100 yards, averaging less than 4 a carry. Is that to complete or conclude the same point we've made for a few players in the defense on this week's show? Is that because this line is terrible? Normally, of course, one of the strongest units in the NFL, but it's banged up and awful. Hasn't got Dak around him. The defense is terrible, so they are letting Games run away from them early on, so he's not getting as many looks as he should. What is going on? Why can't Zeke step up to the levels we're normally used to?
I think it is mostly the lack of supporting cast, but also, like a lot of the players on that Cowboys team, they look beaten. They step on the field and they just don't look like they want to be there. That this has become such a dumpster fire that when Dak Prescott went down, I don't think they realized quite how important he was. We knew the sort of player that he was, but it seemed that they lack leadership and that Zeke does not seem like he's the sort of person who's going to fill that role, which is disappointing. I'm a huge fan of Zeke Elliott. You know, I always say it's him and Saquon Barkley. They are the two running backs in the NFL that are the greats. They are the ones who could reach the Hall of Fame, and I love watching them. And Barkley's not playing, and Zeke Elliott may as well not be. It's such an ugly performance. Like you talk about up with the puppy. I'm so glad that the puppy was asleep for that game, because he was awake when I was watching the Bears Saints game, and when that went to overtime, he vomited, and I was close to doing the same. And if he'd have been watching this game, I don't know what sort of mess we'd have been cleaning up. And my wife's blaming me because I gave the pup, it's so, you know, squirty whipped cream.
Yeah.
Imagine that, but it's chicken liver.
Puppy heaven.
So I gave him some of this. You squirt this foul stuff inside like a kind of like, it's this weird kind of like bouncy rubbery chew toy, and they apparently go crazy for it. He wasn't that keen, but he had enough of it. And clearly from when I saw it come out of him, that's what it was. But I think it was due to some bad football that was played this week that I can't take the whole blame for giving him the squirty chicken liver. And I need that on record for the world to know. History will not judge me for this one. They will judge the Bears offense, and they should just be very pleased that I did not let him watch the Cowboys, because I think that'd have the RSPCA at my door.
Duly noted. And I love this idea of going forwards. We get the squirty chicken liver out, get the pup out, mix them together, and then and time will tell us to what the performance is like that he's watching. So in other words, if it stays in the tum, yeah, fine, okay, we're gonna go another week. If it doesn't, we're gonna have a quarterback change.
Yeah, I mean, I might start talking to him about the spread in each game.
Nice.
Squirt the stuff in his mouth, see what the reaction is. Be like, oh, okay, the Bengals are gonna cover, okay. Mm-hmm. Make a note.
Darwin covers. Great stuff, Ben. At Tweets for Bet is where you can catch Mr. Isaacs on Twitter, not just for NFL stylings, but college as well. He is our resident college expert, of course, and we've got some good college content coming your way soon. Looking forward to doing that with you, bud. Looking forward to having you back on the show. Thanks for doubling down. We'll catch up with you soon.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Great stuff from Ben as ever. Looking forward to this chicken liver prediction mechanic. We're definitely going to investigate that a little bit more. Chicken liver covers. That's something we'll roll on. Speaking of which, we're rolling back Friday with our Week 9 preview. Week 9. My God, we're almost in double digits. We're doubling down. Iron Mike, Darren, Ben making their returns to the show. Darren, of course, a big Eagles fan. So we'll definitely talk about whether he thinks the Eagles are going to win the NFC East, if they're going to win it. Potentially with a losing record. And if that is the case, should they be even allowed in the playoffs? So interested to know what you think about that as well. At the NC show, is that a fair fight? If a team wins a division with a losing record, should they be allowed in the playoffs? Should they be a four seed? At the NC show, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Marley and the crew rolling stuff out all week long on there. So make sure you get stuck in with those channels. And we'll be back. Week 9 preview coming your way Friday. We'll see you then. Bye for now.